From the Ravage Studios of WDIY FM in Bethlehem, PA, it is time for another cabbage conserving hour of chemical-free horticultural hijinks. You bet your garden. Are big green caterpillars munching on your cabbage and other brassica crops? I'm Mike McGrath, and on today's show, I'll reveal how to stop these miserable munchers with companion plants, natural enemies, and BT. Otherwise, it's a fabulous phone call show. Yeah, we're going to take that heaping helping of your telecommunicated questions, comments, tips, tricks, suggestions, and irrationally ironic inquisitions. So stay right where you are, cats and kittens. It's all coming up right after the news.
WDIY News engages the local community through accurate, unbiased reporting from many sources with volunteer real voices. Listen to WDIY News weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m. and 4 to 6 p.m. and weekends from 8 to 10 a.m. WDIY News, available live on 88.1 FM and online at WDIY.org.
Welcome to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY FM in Bethlehem, PA. I am your host, Mike McGrath, and we have a happy story in the news this week. Written by Hannah Nordhaus and published on March 26th by the National Geographic, it's entitled Secrets of the Bees. And we quote, in a mountain valley in northern New Mexico, humans and bees are seen preparing for winter in their Native American community. Indigenous beekeeper and National Geographic explorer Melanie Kirby pried open one of the hives, pulling out the hanging frames and examining them to locate the colony's queen, which was twice the size of the workers. This is our mother breeder, she explains. She has survived many seasons. In April of 2025, American beekeepers reported that 55% of their colonies had perished over the previous year, their worst losses ever. Kirby's honeybees, however, are thriving. She spent the last 20 years working with her farming partner, Mark Spitzig, to breed and raise colonies that are well adapted to New Mexico's high desert and the Rocky Mountain region. Kirby and Spitzig didn't treat their hives with the synthetic chemicals most commercial beekeepers use to fend off the Varroa mite, an invasive parasite that feeds on bees, weakening colonies and carrying viruses, and thought to be the primary culprit in colony die-offs. Instead, they wait to breed their queens until they've lived for at least 2 years, long enough to prove that these bees are hardy and wily enough to survive on their own. Kirby's sturdy and resistant bees also hint at a tantalizing possibility for people who are concerned about the insect's long-term survival. As she sees every day in her apiaries, bees can adapt to their increasingly challenging surroundings if we let them. Perhaps, bee advocates suggest, we've misjudged the insect's ability to adapt to a raft of challenges, like the parasitic Varroa mites that continue to devastate the beekeeping industry. Kirby, for one, has come to believe that this is the case, at least where honeybees are concerned. Beekeepers have for far too long been stuck on a treadmill of chemical treatments to fend off the mites. But eventually those treatments stop working, and we see huge die-offs like the one last year. working with a group of like-minded beekeepers, researchers, and scientists, Kirby founded the Adaptive Bee Breeders Alliance, a national network that promotes beekeeping practices that align with the insect's instincts and intelligence, encouraging the breeding of bees that have been shown to be resilient in their climate and environment. More beekeepers are beginning to believe that the best and strongest bees can survive on their own without miticides. Zia Queen Bees, a company co-owned by Kirby, sells as many as 300 queens a week during spring and summer to beekeepers across the country. And bigger, more commercial operations are also beginning to come around to this point of view. "Don't tell the bees how to do their job," says beekeeper and breeder Randy Oliver, who keeps 1,500 colonies, that's around 60 million bees, in California. "Our job as humans is to be mindful of the habitat that bees need and the poisons and stresses they don't."
You've already discovered that this NPR station is an excellent source of news and entertainment, but did you know that this station is a nonprofit? Public radio is for the public, available to all free of charge. That is possible thanks to people just like you who give what they can to support open access to information. So thank you for listening and for making all of this possible.
Call 610-758-8810 or give online at wdiy.org.
Welcome back to another thrilling episode from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. I am your host, Mike McGrath. If you've ever spent an afternoon plucking green caterpillars off your early season crops like cabbage and broccoli, you're going to want to hear what we have to tell you, because I have at least three different ways to eradicate those pests, all without chemicals, of course. In the meantime, what about another phone call at 610-694-8100, extension number 3.
Hi, Mike. My name is Jerry, and I'm calling from Collinswood, New Jersey. 3 years ago, we had our zoysia grass front lawn removed and installed a native plant pollinator garden. The garden's thriving. However, zoysia grass keeps coming back, specifically in the spaces between the sidewalk squares, and it's even growing from under our tarmac driveway. It's extremely strong and difficult to remove. Do you have any ideas for an organic solution? Thanks.
Zoysia grass, the miracle grass from Florida, I believe it's actually from Vietnam, that was promoted in Parade magazine, which you got with your Sunday paper, for decades. And I know it's decades because my dad fell for it, and he planted zoysia plugs in the front of our little row home. You know, positives, I only had to mow it once a year. Didn't really matter how short I cut it. It didn't need a lot of care, didn't need a lot of food, didn't need a lot of help from watering, but it is a spreading grass. And once it gets in the ground, it's going to extend its territory and reach over not only under your driveway, but your neighbors. You know, eventually it'll take over the whole neighborhood. It doesn't have to do it with seed. It has rhizomes that are very tenacious. Now, you don't say how big your native plant garden is, but really, native plants, great idea. You know, most of them aren't going to compete well with a really aggressive spreader like zoysia. So I'm sorry to say this, and you know, this is a good time of year to do this. Dig up your your plants, or, you know, if they're annuals, don't install them, put them off to the side. And then you have two choices. You can get an old style carpet knife, which is like a scimitar, and you can literally cut rolls of zoysia grass. That's how they sell it. You know, if somebody in your area wants a zoysia lawn, a low care lawn, they can come by and get the sod the day you remove it. There are also tools, power tools, that will do the same chore. I mean, there have to be. Sod is a big business. Then I would suggest you drive edging around the outside of the area you have just cleaned. I'm going to say 6 inches down. You don't have to worry too much about the top. This is an underground spreader. Then level that soil, saturate the soil, and I mean saturate it. We're not talking 20 minutes. We're like talking a day and a half. And then spread clear 2 or 3 mil, M-I-L, clear plastic over top and weight the sides down. That will solarize your soil over the summer. By the end of, I know it's not going to look pretty. Maybe you can get one of those New York signs, you know, temporary inconvenience, you know, permanent confusion. But it really does the job. Kills the rhizomes, and also destroys any diseases or anything else you have in the soil. But you got to do it just the way I said. Clear plastic, not black. I don't care if you got 600 rolls of black plastic. That's not my problem. I didn't buy them. You want clear plastic, level soil, saturated soil, held down with bricks. And you want to leave that on until springtime. And if you wind up missing an area, or you have to do more, well, do it in sections. But always remember to put those edgings down. And that's going to save your pavers or your driveway. I would immediately install edging. And maybe make this stuff even deeper so that it severs the roots. And it's a big job. Zoysia lawn should not be planted on a lark. And they are great grasses, especially down south. They're a warm season grass. So that's the best thing I can offer. But it's like bamboo. You can't let it go for 10 years and then suddenly decide you're going to kick it off the block. But if you keep at it, you're tenacious, don't bother with herbicides. The root system is just too complex and goes further than you might like. But again, if you get most of it done and then you see little clumps showing up around the outskirts, yeah, dig those up. And if you can't get all the rhizomes, pour white vinegar, just regular supermarket white vinegar that's been distilled to 5%. You can also use horticultural vinegars, but as the percentage of acidity increases, so is the danger of their use. So I'm much more comfortable telling people to use 5%. And that has become an important issue. Because now I'm seeing in the supermarket, they got these cleaning vinegars that are like 2%, 4%. No, you don't want to use that. You want to use the basic, you know, white gallon jug that your parents always used. And just stay with it. You should do well. And pick tenacious native plants. Pick ones that are good at holding their own. All right, good luck to you.
Hello, my name is Rose. Just a note that I need my raccoons. I love them. They're great companions. And raccoons eat yellow jackets. So they're quite a blessing. Thank you. Love your program.
Well, thank you, Rose. I'm pleased to discuss this for a moment or two. I guess you're responding to our warnings about raccoons and they're dangerous. But you bring up a trick that I haven't thought about in ages. This will come up later in the season. By the time we get to fall, the yellow jackets have filled their nests with enormous number of stinging hornets, and they're impossible to avoid. And one of my friends, the late Dr. Jim Duke, who was the head researcher for the medicinal properties of plants for the USDA for many, many years, great herbalist, everything like that. Somehow the discussion got to yellow jackets, and I told him the trick that I use when there's just a hole in the ground. It's very obvious. I would go out late at night, and when the guards were kind of sleepy, I would spray, you know, any guards that were outside with Pam. Vegetable oil, no stick yellow jackets. And then slam a glass bowl down over top of the hole. And believe it or not, they would not be able to get out. They won't dig their way out. They're going to die in there. But one thing he said, he had a lot of skunks in his area. So when he discovered a nest, he would go out. He had some special red lens flashlights. And apparently yellow jackets can't see red light. But you always want to do this after dark on a cool night because most of them are down in the nest. And like I said, the guards are sleepy and they're not really looking to attack anybody. So he would have a jar of peanut butter prepared and he would pour the peanut butter over the nest. And again, with a helper, with a can of Pam in case any come after you, until he had a good amount of peanut butter there. And he knew that in the morning, the skunks that were all over the place would have found the peanut butter, and then they are a prime predator of yellow jackets. And I would think the same thing would happen. You didn't go into any kind of detail as to how you would lure them there, but if you can get it close to the nest, hopefully on top of the nesting area, safely and get away, raccoons and skunks will tear that nest apart. They don't get stung or they don't mind getting stung, but it is a great way to eradicate a yellow jacket nest. So thanks for calling, Rose. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and once again remind everybody out there that May is the cruelest month for gardeners who jump the gun. Put on your big gardener pants and wait until the nights are reliably in the 50s to install tender plants like tomatoes, peppers, and squash. I know, I got itchy fingers too, but those who wait will be rewarded. Just don't go checking the long-range forecast right yet, because we'll be right back with many ways to corral the cabbage worm and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from the NPR studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA.
For the past three decades, WDIY has sustained itself through direct contributions from listeners. Our model is simple. The people who listen to the service are the ones who support the service. As WDIY celebrates its landmark 30th anniversary, we invite you to join us as a WDIY member by making a membership gift today. This is something you could do right now to make a meaningful difference in your community. Call 610 694 8100 extension 4 or online at wdiy.org.
Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. I am your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up a little later in the show, people who have cabbage and kale and other cruciferous crops often find that they're being demolished by big green caterpillars. We're going to tell you how to take care of those caterpillars 3, 4, 16 different ways sideways. Right now, you're going to want to hang around for our interview right now with Jeff Akopian from birdsavers.com, who has both invented and cheerleaded a great way to prevent birds from crashing into windows. Jeff, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, Mike.
Now, I think in the email I got from you recently, you were referring to an article that I had just read about the decline in all bird species.
That's correct.
Everywhere, across the board. The good news being there were still a lot of them left behind. But the bad news, it's always bad to have a decline in any large population like that. And part of the problem was habitat loss, which is universal among creatures who are being threatened, and bird strikes. And this was not from you or your company. This was in this massive worldwide studies. And it happens to all of us. And we know that in places like Las Vegas that are hit with light 24/7 and have these giant expanses of glass, these casinos, they need to hire people to sweep up the dead birds a couple of times a day because there's so many strikes. Because as you note, birds can't see through glass, especially when the sun is at a certain direction and everything like that. They're either going to see nothing, which is when they're going to hit the window with a thud, or they're going to see their own reflection and peck away at the window until they lose their bill or the window breaks. But either way, it's not good for the birds, and it has been a difficult problem for people to address. Now, I don't know how long it was ago that you were first on the show, first contacted me, but your family has a long history of engineering. I believe the name and the product is a tribute to your grandfather, who didn't invent anything like this, but he taught all you guys how to be inventors.
Mostly my dad.
Yeah, and it's remarkably simple, and it's something I should remind people about every year because there's nothing worse than hearing that thud. And then do you go out and pretend there's something you can do, or do you just ignore it and hope that nobody else noticed? But you have a very simple solution. And it doesn't involve spinning pie plates or whirligigs or anything. Matter of fact, your solution is not only not obtrusive, people really like it because of the movement. So let's get right to Bird Savers. And you were kind enough, he's in the studio with me. This is a special treat, cats and kittens. This doesn't happen very often. And what you've given me is very simple. You say this is parachute cord.
Yes.
Every 4 feet?
No, inches.
Every 4 inches, there is an attacher, that attaches it just above your window. So that part is out of sight. And is it just press on?
Yeah, it's not every 4 inches where you attach it. It's on the ends. Let's say your window's 3 feet wide. You'd have attachment point on one end, the other end. And basically...
Oh, then the strings that hang down are 4 inches apart.
Yes, the strings that hang down, the cords, the paracord is 4 inches apart. And that's what keeps the birds from flying into the windows.
Right, but the attachers are just at the edges.
Yes, unless you have a long window, then you have something in the middle to hold it up so it doesn't start sagging. Like about every foot we put something, or someone should put something.
So what I'm looking at as I hold it up is these metal things that you won't see, very unobtrusive. Every 4 inches, there is a, how long is it?
As long as the window. So if the window is 5 feet tall, it'll be just a tad like 1 inch under 5 foot. So there's a little bit of space on the bottom.
Okay, so every 4 inches, there is a thin thread, so to speak.
The cord.
Of parachute cord.
Yes.
A cord of cord. This allows the birds to see that they're flying into something.
Right. My theory is that the birds fly through trees. They don't hit the branches generally. So my theory is that they see the cords and they assume they're a branch and they don't hit it.
This has been shown to work very well, right?
Yes.
You've got studies and
yes.
stuff. So yes. Brag.
Brag. Okay. Well, the best example I can give that happened recently is in Houston Botanical Garden in Houston. They called me up about 2 years ago. And they had just spent a lot of money on bird-safe glass, supposed bird-safe glass. And their hummingbirds were still hitting the windows quite often. And they didn't know what to do. They called me up and they said, "Do you think bird savers will help?" I said, "Yes." And so they ordered bird savers and they put them up. And after a 1 year study, it eliminated hummingbirds from hitting the windows, those windows that they were hitting before.
So if it prevents hummingbirds, which are small and fast, in theory, it eliminated all other bird strikes of bigger birds.
Yes. Now, still, anything you put on a window, there's still a chance a bird can hit it. I mean, birds can fly into side of buildings with no windows, and
yeah.
they do that. It doesn't happen often, but it can happen. But yes, 4 inches apart, putting those cords will stop almost 100% of the birds hitting, almost.
Now, we're sitting in front of some really nice, large, industrial-size windows. So we would have this cord of paracord hanging down almost to the bottom, but it is not as obtrusive to us because it's not static.
Yes, it's really interesting because you tell someone putting cords in front of the windows and they think, "Oh, that sounds terrible." But there's so many people who have done this, and most of those people, the people I hear back from, they actually like the cords hanging there. It's kind of, a lot of people have told me it's got a calming effect on them, these cords hanging out the windows. I actually had one young lady tell me that she said, "I can't wait to own a house so I can put these bird savers on the windows because they have such a calming effect on me."
What's the other phrase that people...
Zen wind curtains is the other thing that we call them, but a lot of people have now taken their own names. They call them accopian cords or paracord curtains, but they're all accopian bird savers.
So you've got these cords, and in the least little breeze, they'll be moving around. But paracord is kind of heavy compared to like twine or something like that, so they don't move very quickly. Right? They just kind of gently sway. And as this young lady explained to you, I think you've heard from many people that outside of the bird protection, which makes them feel better about themselves as people, they either get so used to it they don't see them anymore, or like she said, they have a calming effect because they're kind of moving with the wind.
Thus Zen wind curtains.
Yeah, and that way another little part of you is outside. Because obviously people who love big windows, love looking at the woods or the oil refinery or, you know, whether whatever they got. Hopefully it's woods. You know, then a part of them is outside experiencing that breeze.
It's very interesting you said that, because that's very true. I look at cords every day when I wake up. I look and see if the wind's blowing at all, and they almost are always moving. Even when you think there's no wind, you look at the bottom of the cords and it's like, oh, it's moving a little bit, so there must be a little bit of wind out there. It's very interesting.
Now, I love what you do, and I want to just stop for a moment and remind people that we're talking to Jeff Akopian of Akopian Bird Savers, but you don't have to try to figure out how to spell his name, because the website is very simple, birdsavers.com. You can go on the website and you can have, I don't know who does your manufacturing, but you do, hands-on. Everyone, you should sign them. Everyone, a work of art. And you will make them to a specified size and ship them. And then all they got to do is stick them to the corners of the top of the window, and they're good to go. There's no weight at the bottom to bang against the window or anything like that. It's just this gentle movement. But you're not in this to make money. You just want to do the right thing by the birds. So on your website, birdsavers.com, you have free instructions whereby people can make their own.
Yes.
You know, that's kind of giving away the horse there.
Yeah, well, the horse may be needed somewhere.
But of the response you get, what percentage want you to make it for them?
And I don't know, because everyone...
I guess you don't hear back from people who just make them themselves.
I encourage people to, if they make them, send me a photo or... But, I mean, there's probably lots of people who have made them who don't tell me. They just... Which is fine. I started about a year or two ago a page on the website called Where Are Bird Savers? Any that I sell, I put on there. And anybody who tells me that they made them, I put on there. Not those people, but if there's somebody in Easton made them, you'll see Easton listed, and I'll say DIY or how many we've sold in Easton.
If I remember correctly, when I was on your website, that list was not exhaustive. It was exhausting. There were a lot of listings.
Yeah, there's a lot of places, but not enough, because there's so many windows in the world. There's so many windows in the world that are killing birds. And it's not all windows. It's just certain windows kill birds. Not all. It's not like if you see a window, it's going to be killing a bird. That's not necessarily true. You may even have a house that some one or two windows are killing birds or could be killing birds, and the other ones don't kill birds. But one of the problems is, how do you know it's going to kill birds until it kills a bird? And like you were saying before, what do? It kills a bird and you think, oh, well, this is unusual that a bird ran into my window. But it's not. It happens many places.
Now, I'm going to guess that the least safe windows for birds are like the Anderson-style windows, the uninterrupted big pieces of glass.
No, that's not true. In my backyard, in my garden, I have one little window. It's like 8 inches by 8 inches. And I saw a cardinal one day fly into that 8-inch by 8-inch window. So the size really has nothing to do with it.
So once again, this is really simple. It's very inexpensive.
It looks cool.
It looks nice. It is soothing. You can either buy it or make it yourself.
I recommend you make them.
You really do. Now, why is that?
Because I have so many things to do. I mean, I can't make all the bird savers that are needed in the world. If everybody this week went out who needed to stop birds from hitting their windows and made bird savers, the problem would be solved in a week. It would be that simple. But people don't, most people don't care. Bird hits the window, ah, that's a one-off thing. It's not going to happen. But it happens all over the place.
Jeff, I just can't explain enough how much I love and respect the work you do.
Oh, thank you.
Not only coming up with this idea, but giving it away, what a friend of mine calls uncopyrighted. You know, free for all, put it to good use. So
thank you, Mike.
You get our highest endorsement.
Thank you for saying that.
All right. We have been talking with Jeff Akopian of Akopian Bird Savers, a.k.a. Zen Wind Curtains. The website is birdsavers.com. You can feed the birds and see them, too. And save them, too. It's just a great idea, and thank you for looking out for the birds. Last time, birdsavers.com. All right, thanks so much for being with us, and thanks again for coming into the studio. We get lonely in here sometimes.
It's nice in here.
Yeah. All right, well, thank you, Jeff, and best of luck, continued good luck with your bird savers.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you very much.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and add one more piece of advice. Don't subject your precious plants by putting them in the ground first thing in the morning, where they will quickly be blasted by the morning sun. Instead, wait until early evening, and that'll give your plants time to acclimate overnight and avoid the most common cause of transplant shock. So stay right inside right now, because we're going to be back with a dozen different ways to deter and destroy caterpillar pests. Maybe it's more like three or four. And take more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from the NPR studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. Hey, anybody on our crew know what we have planned for next week's show? I'm Mike McGrath, and the crew all ran out of the room, so we got no idea what you'll hear. Join us anyway for the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, and be surprised as the rest of us. Plus your fabulous phone calls. That's on the next You Bet Your Garden. Welcome back to another thrilling episode from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. I am your host, Mike McGrath, and yes, we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. If you've ever spent an afternoon plucking green caterpillars off your early season crops like cabbage and broccoli, you're going to want to hear what we have to tell you, because I have at least three different ways to eradicate those pests, all without chemicals, of course. But in the meantime, how about another phone call at 610-694-8100, extension number 3. Mary, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Mary. How are you?
I'm great. Very, very, very excited to speak with you, Mike.
Oh, very good. Well, I'll try to tamper that down soon enough. Where is Mary Great?
I am in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania.
Oh, okay. We can probably see out the window.
Yes, you can.
All right, what can we do you for?
So previously, my husband and I lived in Bucks County, and we had a problem with carpenter bees on a cedar fence. We've recently, about 2 years ago, relocated to historic Bethlehem, and we have built another cedar fence, though this time we have coated it with three coats of very, like a translucent stain, you know, by preference. But we're concerned about carpenter bees. Is there anything preventative that's not toxic to anything that we can use?
Yes. Well, first of all, cedar is the favorite wood of carpenter bees. It is known to be super durable and rot resistant, but it's also soft. So they love it when they make their galleries to raise their young inside that wood. But obviously, this is a common problem. And although they don't cause structural damage, believe it or not, people get freaked out because they're big bees flying around. So researchers testing out different ways to make the wood unappealing to carpenter bees without harming the bees found that if you coated it with almond oil, they were repulsed by that, and they never tried to build galleries. Now, you have not had anybody nosing around yet, right?
Right.
Okay. Now, when I say almond oil, a lot of people are thinking, oh, when I go to Whole Foods, that's $100,000 for half an ounce. But almond oil is the carrier oil for massage therapists. They buy it by the gallon, like a gallon of vinegar. And if you get it from a massage therapy supply house, or even go to your nearest massage place and see if you can buy a gallon off them, it's very inexpensive. And what I would suggest, because you have stained it already, and I'm no expert at woodworking, so you might want to talk to somebody who has a brain and may have a better idea of this. But I'm thinking if you were to sand it down lightly so that you keep some of the original stain, but that the almond oil has a chance to sink in and penetrate, that you should be good. And more importantly, if you notice the very first signs of activity, you definitely want to get out there with some sandpaper or sanding machine and sand that area down, coat it with almond oil, and keep your eye open. I would hate for you to do it after they start to build their galleries, because they are tremendous pollinators, and they're not hurting anybody. They're just raising a family the way they have for endless millennia. But if you can prevent it up front, they'll still be around. They'll just nest in a natural area somewhere near you and or in the neighbor's fence. And but they'll still come and pollinate your flowers.
Okay. Well, I think it sounds like we've done things out of order, but we'll try that. We'll try sanding the fence a little bit and trying the almond oil.
I surprised you, didn't I, that I knew something?
No, you did not surprise me, because I will forever remember the episode where you talked about the windmills near The Hague. And that, to me, was the best show I've heard in a long time.
Oh, thank you.
Very, very meaningful. So I thought, when I thought of this issue, I thought I'm gonna try to find out from Mike. So thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. That's a great memory. I really appreciate that. All right, you take care now.
Okay, thanks very much. Bye bye.
Bye bye. As promised, it is time for the question of the week, which we are calling companion planting for cabbage pests. Betsy near Cincinnati writes, "I've read about companion planting to repel white cabbage moths in a couple of my gardening books. Is there an annual flower or herb I can plant that will repel the moth? I'm getting tired of checking each leaf of kale for caterpillars before I make a salad. Well, you know, Betsy, it could be worse. That's added protein with your greens there. Well, your basic answer is yes, but it doesn't work the way you're thinking. The plants in question actually attract beneficial mini wasps whose larvae parasitize many caterpillar pests. I will note here for waspahobix that these creatures are so tiny, it's hard to see them, so they pose no stinging threat to you. They are a popular mail-order biocontrol. Last time I checked, they're shipped in the egg form, stuck to cards that you place near the plants most often attacked, which are typically members of the brassica family, like cabbage, broccoli, and Brussels sprouts. But sometimes they migrate to our sacred tomatoes, another plant that their green caterpillar form can nicely mimic the leaves of the plant. The plants that attract the adult form of these wasps are many and include yarrow, which is a good overall attractor of parasitic and predatory insects, dill, fennel, Queen Anne's lace, which is said to be especially attractive to the family of mini wasps you wish to attract, sweet alyssum, borage, and cilantro / coriander. They provide pollen and nectar to the adults, the females of which then seek out a caterpillar and inject eggs into it. Like the xenomorph creature that filmgoers know as the alien, the larvae that emerge from these eggs consume their prey carefully from the inside, making their hosts last until the wasps are fully grown and can emerge with enough energy to fly back to those pollen and nectar plants to get a sugar rush and then continue the cycle. So, the quote companion plants in this scenario don't have any kind of actual repellent activity. No plant really does. They just attract the wasps whose babies eat your caterpillars from the inside out. I would be remiss if I did not also mention that many birds like to feed on big, juicy caterpillars. The wasps may be tiny, but these caterpillars are pretty big. Chickadees and nutthatch are the best predators, and their preferred habitat is around people's homes. So the only thing you need to do is provide a constant and clean, fresh source of water. You don't want to put up bird feeders because that would fill their bellies up with seed and they would have no interest in your pests. These birds are very good at finding food in nature, especially in the form of garden pests. But clean water can be scarce in the summer. So the more bird baths you put out, the more pest eaters you will attract. Hey, and don't neglect chickens. They generally don't bother fully grown plants, just tiny little sprouts, and the protein from the caterpillars helps them produce more nutritious eggs. If you don't want them pecking around and fertilizing your garden, handpick the caterpillars off the plants and toss them in the chicken coop. Yum. Outside of nature's predators, your best weapon against destructive, quote, worms is the old original form of BT, a naturally occurring soil organism that you spray on the plants they're damaging. As soon as a caterpillar starts munching on a sprayed leaf, their stomachs stop working and they soon die. BT is the first in a family of related strains that have been found to be specific against specific pests. It's often just called DiPel, as that was the trade name it was sold under for many years, and probably still is. It harms nothing else. A toad or a bird can eat a caterpillar that is already dying from BT, and it won't be harmed. BT, short for Bacillus thuringiensis, only affects caterpillars that eat the leaves of the sprayed plants, period. BT does not harm bees, birds, pets, butterflies, true worms, wombats, or toads. Toads are another great predator of these pests, by the way. Place their water on the ground instead of up high. BT only affects caterpillars, and the caterpillars have to eat the sprayed leaves of the plant for it to be effective. So don't spray your parsley. That's the host plant for the, quote, worm that produces the beautiful eastern black swallowtail butterfly. Note, the outdated term worm, a moniker that early farmers applied to pest caterpillars, is erroneous. It's also wrong. True worms do not harm plants, but farmers still use names like tomato hornworm, corn earworm, and cabbage worm to describe what's eating their farm to the ground. And of course, don't spray milkweed with BT, lest you harm the caterpillar form of the monarch butterfly, which is probably why you planted the milkweed in the first place. Very cool, however, an adult monarch can land on a plant that's been sprayed by BT and not be affected. It has to be a caterpillar that's feeding on the leaves of the plant. Oh, and the innocent-looking day-flying white, quote, moth fluttering around your cabbage has a weird taxonomy. I found it listed under many names. And so I quote Wikipedia. Wiki reveals that what we call the cabbage moth is actually a small to medium-sized butterfly in the whites and yellows family. It is known in Europe as the small white, in North America and the United Kingdom as the cabbage white or cabbage butterfly. And on several other continents, it's known as the small cabbage white, and in New Zealand as the white butterfly. Traditionally known in the United States as, quote, the imported cabbage worm, now more commonly called the cabbage white, the caterpillars are bluish green with tiny black spots. And now you know how to get rid of them. Sure was a lot of good caterpillar control advice. Now, wasn't it? Luckily, you can read the details over at your leisure or your leisure by following the link for the Gardens Alive question of the week at the top of the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Yikes, my producer is threatening to hide my BT if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 610-694-8100 or send us your email, you're tired, you're poor, you're wretched refuse teeming to our garden shore at youbetyourgarden1@gmail.com. And if you happen to live anywhere, knock on your neighbor's door, ask where that place is, and tell us. And visit our Facebook page, where we post new photos of our gardens and invite you to send us photos of your precious plants, share your thoughts about the show, receive important and informative updates about our upcoming move to another venue, a link to the written version of the Gardens Alive question of the week, and links to our podcast. It's all at the overcrowded You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. You Bet Your Garden is a public radio show and podcast produced and delivered to you every week from the studios of NPR station WDIY in Bethlehem, PA. You Bet Your Garden was created by Mike McGrath. Mike McGrath was created when he fell down in the dirt and accidentally uncovered the potato he'd been looking for all day. Speaking of spuds, our musical director is Ken Queter. Our social media director is Amanda Norfleet. Our peerless prince of profound production is James Ziprobe. Margaret McConnell is the executive director of WDIY-FM. Our executive producer is the always lovely Jonas Bowen. And our incredible assistant is the awesome Ninja Sean. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and my snow peas are up and looking good. The lettuce is lovely. The first potato sprouts just broke the surface of the soil. And my alpine strawberry plants not only overwintered, they are healthy and huge. So I got nothing to complain about. Maybe I'll come up with something by the time I see you again next week.